I'm Walter Story, and the title of this session is Do Good Lutherans Make Good Citizens? And I'm going to answer that question right at the beginning, and then we'll see why. The answer to the question, do good Lutherans make good citizens, is not very. But they should. Well, that might be another question. I think they should and could. Now, this subject was put into today not because this was my suggestion as to what session I could do that would fit into the day. I had presented a series of topics for this week, and Charlie put it into this day. And it seems to me to be not overtly a peace-oriented issue, except as I was listening to John this morning, it does tie in, because if the persons who are concerned that, not only concerned about peace, but that what the church can contribute to the conversation and the action for peace, if that's going to happen, how else is it going to be fed into the public arena where decisions have to be made, if the persons who hold those views and convictions are not involved? So that's one way in which it is relevant. And another way of putting it would be, one of the reasons why we seem to be in a situation where those values which Christians hold regarding peace seem not to be included in the public arena, and so we have to address it as something new and a big issue, is because there has been a reluctance or a neglect by Lutherans, among others, to be involved on an ongoing basis. So the subject of Lutherans and citizenship is not related exclusively to the matter of peace, and yet it seems to me to be a background issue, that taking seriously our citizenship is a way in which our concerns for peace, as well as any issue that is of public nature, is going to be addressed. And we probably ought to define what a good Lutheran is. I'm trying to be simple today. A good Lutheran would be a committed, active, knowledgeable member of the Lutheran Church. And I'm not going to try to define committed, nor active, nor knowledgeable. But generally, when we speak of that term, a good Lutheran, that's what I have in mind. Someone who is a committed, active, knowledgeable member of the church. Is willing to say, I'm a Lutheran. Carries on some activities which identifies him or her with the Lutheran church. And knows something about what it means to be Lutheran. I don't want to be exclusively Lutheran in what is included in this, because I know that there's at least one person in the room who's not Lutheran. And I guess that if you're not Lutheran, you could be running through your own head how this might apply to your own denomination. Actually, there are at least three people that are not Lutheran here. Now, what is a good citizen? Well, I'll try to keep that just as simple. A good citizen is a committed, active, knowledgeable member of the larger community. So, rephrase the question. Do committed, active, knowledgeable members of the Lutheran Church make committed, active, knowledgeable members of the larger community? And if I rephrase that now, I certainly would say a good Lutheran ought to be a good citizen, and if the Lutheran is not a good citizen, perhaps that reflects on how good a Lutheran he or she is. But let's go into some of the data for my original statement, and that is that good Lutherans don't make very good citizens. The most recent data to help us answer that question is a book, Profiles of Lutherans in the USA. Profiles of Lutherans in the USA, published 1982. The author is Carl Reuss, R-E-U-S-S, and like Price, only this is Reuss, and it's Augsburg Publishing Company. The data for this book was collected in 1980, so it's about as recent a large-scale collection of data as exists on Lutherans. It's profiles of Lutherans in the USA, meaning what the Lutherans look like generally. It's not saying what Lutherans ought to look like or what they ought to believe or what they ought to do, but what in fact, when you look at them on a survey basis, who the Lutherans are, what kind of beliefs they hold, and how do they see their faith relating to their action. It's a sampling of members of 8 Lutheran denominations in the United States. Did you know there were that many? That isn't all of them, but it does represent 99% of the Lutherans in the United States. And it describes Lutherans on a large number of subjects and makes some division on the basis of age, whether male or female, whether they are laity or clergy. And put an aside there, that's actually a misnomer. It's not laity and clergy. Technically, all of us are laity. Some of the laity are clergy. So this would be laity who are clergy and laity who are not clergy would be another way of making that division. And then by region, which is not directly relevant to what we're talking about this morning, but is interesting. The regions are northeastern United States, north central United States, southern United States, and western United States, and defined fairly much as you'd expect. I'll just say that there's one point of interest to me, and if we think of north central United States as a kind of a heartland of Lutheranism, although it's not the only one, but what would you say of the 4 areas, northeast, north central, south, and west, what would be the most affinity with the north central region? In other words, where, what other region would you expect to be closest to north central of those other 3?
West.
South. Anybody for northeast? That's west. Yeah, not in all factors, but generally closer between north central and west, and I was reading this on the trip up here a couple weeks ago, and I was all excited about this and mentioned it to Bobby, and she said, well, that makes sense because all of the Lutherans in the West came from North Central, or many of them. And Northeast tends to be most least Lutheran and most influenced by the culture in which they live. Now that did interest me because it seems to me that the West would be more distinctly influenced by the culture. And that also is not particularly relevant to this subject. But, excuse me, about the South? Well, after the Northeast, the South is most peculiar in its Lutheranism. And then, of course, it also has the ethnic makeup of the church, and then the South is quite different in its ethnic makeup than the North Central, well, any of the other areas. So that but I want to, there's one chapter that is particularly relevant to our subject, and that is the chapter 5, Involvement in the Community. Here are some relevant findings. Lutherans are strongly optimistic about their own personal future, their family relations, their congregation, their church body. And men and women differ little in their feeling about these matters. They are more often pessimistic than optimistic about the national economy and about world affairs. Now, I think Gallup polls or that kind of thing that I've seen about the nation generally, that also holds true. People just tend to be more optimistic about their personal life than they are about the world in general or the economy. And so Lutherans are pick that up. And it doesn't make any difference on age. Lutherans of all ages are more pessimistic than optimistic about world affairs. The same is true about regional variations. Now, clergy are markedly more optimistic than laity in their appraisal of their family relations and the local congregation, and markedly more pessimistic than laity in their appraisal of the national economy, the country, and world affairs. So it's the same. The clergy and laity both are more optimistic about their personal life, more pessimistic about the world, but the clergy more so, more optimistic about the one and more pessimistic about the other. Then clergy are concerned about governmental and political parties, political party matters, almost twice as often as our laity. And the majority of the clergy concerned about the area are active in the cause. But now the point is not that clergy are more so, but the percentages of persons. The Lutherans were asked to list local, state, and national causes about which they are concerned. And there are a number of areas: gun control, school education, government, political party, environment, pollution, civil rights protection, economy, crime control, ERA, taxes, hospital auxiliary. The largest percentage is 9%. In other words, no more than 9% of Lutherans in this sample, but a representative sample, are particularly concerned about any given national cause or issue. And the two are gun control on the one hand and school educational matters on the other. Men are more concerned about gun control, women more concerned about the education. So there aren't a whole lot of people that are concerned on any particular issue among Lutherans. But then it just notes that the clergy tend to be concerned in larger proportion than the laity. All right, let's see what other...
How did they measure concern? Was this, are you active in, or are you concerned about, you know?
Let's see. Both. One is to list causes which you are concerned about. And then the second one was, are you actively engaged in that? Okay. And it tended to be that those who are concerned tend to be active in the, well, let's see. Now, only among those concerned about hospitals and their auxiliaries are the majority active in that cause. So that would say that, let's see, 5% of the people were concerned about hospital and hospital auxiliary matters, and half of them were active. And women are particularly concerned. So you've got not a whole lot of concern, and then precious little activity among those who are concerned.
Well, I don't want to push that too far. Was it an open-ended question, or is it a check-off list? Do you recall?
The open-ended was in terms of listing the causes.
Okay.
How did they poll it? Not every Lutheran, or two congregations, or?
Well, let's see. Cross-section of members of 8 Lutheran bodies. I think the data is in here. I think the point is that I think they went through congregations to get a sample of, and they feel that the percentage of return, both the selection of the sample and the percentage of returns then, gives fairly good confidence that we're speaking for Lutherans generally in 1980. And a second statistic that was gathered was persons who are members of a particular organizations. Now, as you'd expect, 53% of the laity are members of a church-affiliated group. And you'd almost expect. I suppose that means other than the congregation itself. Then 20% of the laity are in professional associations. Then there's a category, community involvement. 16% in service clubs, 8% in political groups. Social action groups, 9%, school service club, 15%. So no more than 16% in that service club, and school service club, 15%. But political group and social action group that would be related particular to kind of an overt citizenship, 8 and 9%.
I would think, just by way of comment, that would not probably differentiate them a whole lot from the general public.
Uh-huh.
You might find the Catholics more politically, that'd be my guess.
Okay.
Talk about the general public.
Now, it's interesting that in most of that category of service clubs, political groups, social action groups, the clergy are almost, well, in some cases, more than twice the proportion. For example, social action groups, 9% of the laity, 25% of the clergy. Even in the political groups, 8% of the laity and 14% of the clergy. So the conclusion of this particular thing is that apart from service groups and school service organizations, Lutherans are only minimally involved in their communities. Though they join work-related groups in large numbers, they do so more out of obligation than for personal satisfaction. And then it raises the question, does it have something to do with Lutherans' pessimism about the national economy and world affairs? Being so pessimistic, it discourages one from being concerned. Okay. Now that, there is another study of Lutherans, looks like more major, it's a much thicker book, called The Study of Generations. Similar poll, except it is only among ALC, LCA, and Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. But that is, I suppose, 75 or 80% of the Lutherans, maybe more, actually. So, and this was data gathered in 1970, and almost the same conclusion about the general involvement of Lutherans in community kinds of affairs is true, that a small number of Lutherans, small percentage of Lutherans are actively involved. Now, you could, I suppose, propose that one can be a good citizen without formally expressing that citizenship through groups or activity and causes. I'm not sure what that would look like. I think neither one of them, I think, asked how many voted in the last election. And that might indicate a higher level of involvement. But I don't know that that would be the case. But if you're asking the question, are Lutherans as individuals active members of their community beyond residing in the communities and perhaps voting, the answer would be no. Now, Duane's point is that that probably doesn't make them any different from the rest of the citizens. That doesn't mean it's good, however. It means that Lutherans are no more effective in translating the values, the concepts, the understandings of their faith into community action than others. And then if you put it the other way and say others are no more than Lutherans, then we get kind of the full impact of what this means to a community in which those persons who presumably have specific ideas as to how people ought to live together are not actively involved in feeding those into the public arena and translating them into action. A side comment to me is that perhaps the issue which I think others, tend to raise regarding community involvement, we have said that Lutherans don't like their church corporately to be involved. They say that's the role of individuals. Individuals should have the responsibility to translate their faith into community involvement. But I think this indicates that that's not being done either. So it's not church, you keep out of it, because us as individuals, we're in there. This would say if the individuals were, the corporate action of the church might not seem to be such an issue because we are actively involved as individuals. But this suggests to me that, in fact, the church as an institution may be more active than individuals, and if it weren't, the church would be hardly represented at all, consciously at least, in the public arena. And the study of generations indicates that reluctant as Lutherans appear to be about the church being involved in public affairs, perhaps they are more willing that the church be involved as an institution than they are ready themselves as individuals to be concerned. So if we're saying where the most room for change, for growth, for significant impact for the church is, this data would suggest it's in getting people as individuals interested and involved in their communities. Okay, now, second question is, if we take that as a general statement, that Lutherans don't seem to be actively, overtly involved in their citizenship as Lutherans, as Christians, how does this happen? Is there something about being Lutheran that historically, theologically, would act as a restraint upon our involvement? So we could say, well, it's because we're Lutherans. Lutherans don't get actively involved. If you think of who were the first Lutherans, who were the first ones who made a kind of a splash in world history, it was a group of Lutheran politicians who were the signers of the Augsburg Confession. They were not Lutheran preachers. They were the princes and the, what were the, there were some electorates, and they were from some free cities. But these were the leaders, the political leaders of the area in which Lutheranism took hold, who signed the Augsburg Confession. So on that one point, you can say that it was politicians who provided the power factor that made it possible for the Lutheran Church to take a hold in Germany as it did. So certainly Lutheranism does not come into being through political quietists or pacifists. These are the persons whose occupation is the running of the public arena. Luther himself, I think, made several statements that I think ought to move us toward the public arena. For example, he said, not for example, he said, the God-pleasing life is both a possibility and a responsibility. Through grace, by faith, we are made right, we are reconciled with God. What we do not do that which is pleasing to God in order to win His favor. But by faith, through grace by faith, we have been freed, we are reconciled with God, and Luther says that sets us free then to live the God-pleasing life. And not only are we free to live the God-pleasing life, but we are responsible for that. It's not just all right, it's not just possible, but it's expected of us that we live the God-pleasing life. Now, what is pleasing to God? Luther says that which is most pleasing to God is that which serves what God has created. The earth, the neighbor. It is life service in the world. So where do we find our Christian vocation? Not withdrawing from the world and focusing our thoughts on heaven or the spiritual relation between ourselves and God. Now we're free there. That's taken care of. We are free now and responsible to please God by serving that which God has created. So that's the second point. We are free and responsible to live the God-pleasing life. Where do you do that? How do you do it? By service in the world. And then the third point is, by what means are we of service? And Luther says we are of service to our neighbor through our everyday occupations. Again, it's not spare time activity. Like when you're doing the things of making a living, that's not serving God. That's not pleasing to God. But those are the very means, the very vehicles by which we do that which is pleasing to God. For Luther, these were the occupations of some of the examples he uses, the person who makes beer barrels, the shopkeeper, the woman functioning as wife, mother, and I think Luther is not an ERA person, but I think the woman in Luther's understanding is the woman is the person who runs the household. So it's not a an employee subservient role for women, but seeing women as having an executive position in the home, to be sure, but nevertheless that is a role of authority and initiative. And it includes the prince, the burgher, the person who is in charge of public affairs. That also is an occupation through which we serve neighbor. And it would be not only the sovereign, but the citizen as well. Well, it's a different kind of citizenship in those days. Many people was not voting who your sovereigns were going to be. But nevertheless, there is definitely a citizen role. And Luther is saying that it is in that citizen role where we are of service to our neighbor, where we do that which is pleasing to God. So civic responsibility becomes a major area in which we are both free to and expected to live the God-pleasing life, be of service to our neighbor. And Luther had a strong understanding of the civic order, or the civic realm, as that place where order is maintained so that people may live at peace with one another, and where the gospel can be preached freely in a situation of tranquility. And Luther also has a sense of justice, or at least welfare. The purpose of the state is, or the community. Luther has writings on the community chest, the idea of the public welfare system, on education. Particularly those two areas were of great concern to Luther, education and the public, and kind of a public welfare system. That's part of civic responsibility. So it's not just maintaining order. There's also a responsibility for providing the kind of life which is humane and fulfilling for humans. I think it has to be noted that Luther has much higher expectations as to what can be accomplished in the realm of order than he does of justice and the general well-being. And from that standpoint, Luther comes out as politically encouraging, that is, encouraging us to become active politically, but socially limiting. That is, the vision that he has of what can be accomplished through political activity is quite conservative. A modicum of order and a certain basic meeting of the necessities of life. Luther is not at all optimistic about, he would not be a great society person, at that time at least. Now, what he would think now is not clear, but Luther functions, if we're trying to tie Lutheran behavior today to Luther himself, we can see those two strains. I think Luther would, if we're true to Luther, we would want to get involved and active in the citizen life, both as citizens and as persons holding political office, as well as in voluntary organizations. Luther really is pushing us in that direction. Somewhat restraining, though, in terms of our expectations through that kind of activity. But I think that can be related a good deal to the situation. Nevertheless, there is a task to accomplish that is possible, and we are to employ our reason in doing it. I think that's another important contribution that Luther is making, is the employment of one's reason is the employment of a gift that God has given to us to exercise in the public realm. So reason is not a lesser faculty to faith or piety, for example. And so some of his writings are reminding the magistrates, the sovereigns, that God has given them the gift of reason and they ought to use it. So our understanding of politics as pragmatic, practical, accomplishing what can be done, laying the groundwork today for what can be done tomorrow, using the reason strategy, is very much in keeping with what Luther had in mind for Christians in the public realm. Reason, however, which by Christians should be informed by our faith, informed by what we believe about God, his intentions for the world, and his desire that we be of service to our neighbor. So in the early Reformation, I think this relative inactivity among Lutherans really can't be grounded in the early experience of the Reformation. There's a contrary experience. In Germany and in Scandinavia, I think even today, you would find Lutherans more in touch with the public realm as Lutherans, or that the government would be more, a greater interpenetration of government. In the part of Germany, at least, where Lutherans are active, which happens to be East Germany, so that's a little more difficult. But I think relative to that situation, more interpenetration, and certainly in the Scandinavian countries. It's interesting that the social welfare states, in their most advanced extent are in predominantly Lutheran countries. And I think we can't write that off as coincidental. It must be something about the experience of Lutherans in those countries which have moved in that direction. In the United States, I think it's interesting to remind ourselves of some of the things, the connection of Lutherans in the United States. One of the things that is particularly interesting is the Muhlenberg family. This was early ULCA progenitors, the Lutherans, part of the German strain, and which comes through now in the LCA. But Henry Melchior Muhlenberg is one of the fathers of the ULCA. And Henry Melchior had three sons. Now, it's interesting that Henry Melchior was ready for retirement in about 1776. So at the time of the American Revolution, he's thinking retirement. And it says that he was officially neutral toward the war and tried to carry on his ministry. And a few months after 1776, he writes, "Robbed of my former protection, old and cast aside, unwilling to change my oath of allegiance, nor yet to be a sacrifice to anarchy at the hands of the angry mob, I retired. To a little country place of 7 acres in Trapp, Pennsylvania, intended for poor superannuated Lutheran preachers or poor widows in the hope of having a quiet retired life." I think that's so interesting because the image I have of 1776 is the whole countryside out with their muskets or manufacturing ammunition. Here's Henry Melchior Muhlenberg retiring to a quiet country place in Kraft, Pennsylvania for old pastors and poor widows. The fact that it was even possible to do that in that. But now his three sons, one of them was, this is Henry Ernst, a learned preacher and scholar, also received international acclaim as a leading botanist, who was known as the American Linnaeus. Is that the biologist? Mm-hmm. Linnaeus? Yes, so it would be the Latin Linnaeus here. Okay. And he diligently carried out his religious and scientific pursuits while virtually oblivious to the turmoil and suffering of the American Revolution. He was a political quietist whose religious spirit was far less conscious of God's presence in history than in nature. Now, I think that's interesting. Really conscious of God's activity in nature, takes that seriously, a biologist, a botanist. But politics seems to be something that passes him by. Now, the second son, Peter Gabriel, gained widespread fame as a militant supporter of the revolutionary cause. January of 1776, while still an ordained clergy, he secretly accepted a colonel's commission in the Army of Virginia, and then came out of the secrecy and revealed to his congregation that he had taken a commission in the Army and served the in the Army during the Revolutionary War without ever giving up his ordained status. So here was someone who felt not only was it all right to be a soldier, but to be clergy and soldier at the same time. And then after a notable career in the Continental Army, eventually rising to the rank of Major General under the command of George Washington, he entered political affairs and was elected Vice President of Pennsylvania. I didn't know that Pennsylvania had a president. I guess that was. Then served as a member of the House of Representatives in the 1st, 3rd, and 6th Congress, finally becoming a member of the United States Senate. A Republican of the spirit of Jefferson, he championed human rights and constitutional government. So there's another Muhlenberg who goes the other extreme and becomes actively involved, first in the war for independence and then for in the government that followed. Then a third son is Frederick, who was opposed to the Tories, that is the British side, but continued to serve as a pastor of a number of rural congregations outside Philadelphia. After the war, he left the pastorate and was elected one of Pennsylvania's three delegates to the Continental Congress. became a powerful figure in Pennsylvania politics for the rest of his life. Represented his electorate nationally in the first four Congresses of the House of Representatives, served as Speaker of the first and third Congresses in the House. Conservative Federalist who worked hard to protect the gains of the Revolution and institutional structures that could endure the tests of time. Now it's interesting that he took issue with his brother Peter, not because Peter went into politics, which Frederick did also, but because Peter maintained his status as clergy. Frederick felt he needed to give up his status as clergy. But in this one family, you have a spectrum of involvement, from withdrawal, retirement, to kind of oblivion, to oblivious, to actively involved as a clergy person, and actively involved but giving up that status as clergy. The point being, I think, though, that there was no sense that Lutherans, as Lutherans, ought not to be involved in civil politics, but in fact take active leadership. Lutherans during the Civil War responded pretty much as most denominations were, very much a product or reflected their environment. And there were three Lutheran journals being published at that time. There was a Lutheran Herald, which was published in the North, was anti-slavery, even espousing the abolitionist cause. There was the Southern Lutheran, which defended slavery and slaveholders. There was the Lutheran Observer, which was a border states publication, and it was open to both sides. It's interesting, however, that historically, then looking back into these journals, it is clear that they were aware of what was going on politically. That's the good news. The bad news is that they seem not to have a perspective which is not considerably shaped by the particular environment in which it lives. It doesn't seem to have a statement to make from outside of the particular cultural situation. The Norwegians and Swedes, these are very gross statements in the sense of generalizations. And I think this north-south border is primarily Lutherans in the eastern part of the United States. And these would be more the German and English, to the extent that there were those. Norwegians and Swedes, and this would be, I think, before the largest immigration, wouldn't it, of Norwegians and Swedes, Civil War? The extent that they were here and were making themselves known were vigorously anti-slavery and Republican. Interesting combination, isn't it, when you look at it? Of course, Lincoln was Republican. There was a journal called Hemlandet. Is that correct, Hemlandet? Would that be Homeland? Published by T.N. Hasselquist. And it's interesting that this is probably is a Norwegian, is that right, Norwegian? Language, Swedish?
Swedish.
Swedish language journal. The others seem to be in English by this time. But this is in Swedish, and yet it reflects an anti-slavery sentiment. It is said that a strong Lutheran element in St. Louis saved it from the secessionists. So again, there is involvement in what's going on. And it probably also indicates that in some of these places, Lutherans as Lutherans are a significant enough number or body that they're in a position, if they get themselves together, to influence what's going on politically. In 1862, the General Synod, which had been organized in 1820, included both North and Southern states, churches from North and Southern states. This is the General Synod. But at the annual meeting of 1862, the Southern Synods, Southern states, churches in the Southern states did not attend. And they were read out of the General Synod. Apparently they did not secede from the General Synod, but the General Synod excluded them from membership. And therefore, in 1863, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, and Georgia, the Lutheran churches within those states, organized the United Synod of the South. And And so this split that took place in 1862 and 1863 among Lutherans was maintained until 1918, when the United Lutheran Church in America was formed. Yeah, the Presbyterians are just now getting together. But that still has to be ratified by congregations, I understand. But the Lutherans were split by the Civil War for 50 years or more, only getting together finally in 1918. Well, this is some of the things that happened with Lutherans. Another interesting person is J.H.W. Stuckenberg, who was publishing in 1880 a journal called Christian Sociology. And Stuckenberg had an interesting combination of preaching the gospel, establishing charitable institutions, and organizing attempts to create solutions to social problems. Now, if you're trying to say what Lutherans are willing to do, most Lutherans are willing to preach the gospel. And most of those Lutherans would also say that it's all right for Lutherans to establish charitable institutions. And so Lutherans have made a very significant contribution to American society through its hospitals, its social welfare organizations, its homes for the aged, and there have been orphanages or children's homes. But we become much more reluctant at the point then of organizing solutions to social problems. But here in 1880 is J.H.W. Stuckenberg, who is taking on the whole range of social issues. There was also a rather strong temperance movement in the 1890s among the Norwegian churches. The United Norwegian Church and the Hauge Norwegian Synod took active prohibition stands. The point, I think, is that Lutherans historically have been considerably active in public affairs, but the American experience seems to show a kind of a sifting out of various stances among Lutherans. The interesting thing to me is to say that, to note that Lutheran activism, which we've noted in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, in other words, Lutherans who become political or social activists, are not a new thing among Lutherans in America. It may be a renewed thing in this time, but throughout the history of Lutherans in the United States, there are political and social activists. And it has been more or less of a rare thing. There have at times been considerable numbers of people. But we also seem to find among Lutherans in America a sense that Lutherans, good Lutherans, ought not to take too active a part in public affairs, usually with the sense that this is an arena which ought to be left to other people or other institutions. And maintain this is somehow God's activity, but that it's a lesser service. If you get into it, it's almost by force, or because you can't find something more pleasing to God to do. There is that other side of it. Now, a question is trying to pin this down, and this book, The Study of Generations, tries to get at what there is operating within Lutheranism that causes us to withdraw from, become pessimistic about, even cynical about the public arena. And what comes out of the study of generations as its hypothesis is what it has identified as a very strong law orientation among Lutherans. Now, I think about that when the session we had on homosexuality, where I was starting from, if you're asking where Lutherans are, you start from them as an evangelical group and starting from the gospel. Now, what this study identified among Lutherans is a law orientation. And this is what they say about Lutherans who manifest a law orientation. Begins by saying that Lutheran theology asserts there is only one false religion. That is living under the law without knowledge of the gospel. Now here there, this is a statement about the way Lutherans ought to be. Lutherans have said theologically and historically that the one false religion is living under the law without knowledge of the gospel. Now law as a theological term here, not political in a sense. And Lutherans have defined the form that this false religion takes within the church. It has described the beliefs and attitudes and behaviors connected with law orientation. Now, approximately 40% of the Lutheran population manifests varying but significant degrees of law orientation. And here's where it's beginning to zero in now. Saying while a law orientation has been identified by Lutherans as the one false religion, 40% of American Lutherans, on the basis of this survey, have a law orientation. For those whose religion is primarily law orientation, external structures, including patterns of behavior, social system, and social stratification, assume ultimate importance. All right, to have a law orientation says the things that are most important to us are structures, patterns of behavior, social system, social stratification, and rigidity, resistance to change, exploitation of religion and society for the satisfaction of personal needs, absolutism, conformity to consensual morality, and that is what most people believe, and attitudes of prejudice toward other persons characterize such persons. There is a tendency for law-oriented persons to reject the full humanity of Jesus. They don't like to recognize that Jesus was fully human. Belief in salvation by works tends to distinguish a law orientation from a gospel orientation at the most obvious level. Belief in salvation by works. So you have a law orientation that is highly, well, let's see, I think I've said all it has about it. One thing that isn't noted here is that there's also among law-oriented people a resistance to change. Now that fits if you're concerned about structures and life as it is remaining, you want it to remain such. Any change threatens the way things are. And if you have a great investment in the way things are, then change is going to be threatening. Now, I don't know what you think about this, but I think instead of trying to open it out, let's stop at this point and give a little thought to that. Why do Lutherans tend not to become actively involved in politics? And let's say particularly in politics that is concerned about social change, transforming culture to make it more humane, to make it more just, make it more orderly in a just sense, to wage peace, to try things that are different from the way they've been. According to this, it's because a significant proportion of us, when we think religiously, think very much in terms of law rather than gospel. And our religion, to the extent that we are conscious of our religion, promotes us to think of the public arena as something that is there to serve our individual purposes. And that we see our individual purposes best served by keeping the things the way they are. Even though we're probably rather cynical about how good they are. And because we don't think they're very good, we don't want to get too involved with them. But nevertheless, they're better than what they might be if you start tampering with them. Now, to take that one step further, the reason good Lutherans don't make good citizens is because 40% of us are not good Lutherans. If we think of being good Lutheran as having this gospel orientation. Now, we're mixing sociological research, political theory, and theology, and faith. And that's a mixture that can get us into trouble. But let's get some response from you in those terms. Do you see the law orientation present? Do you see that as an inhibiting factor? Do you see other reasons for Lutherans not being involved? Do you, on the other hand, feel Lutherans are quite involved in the political arena?
I continue my history orientation, not the predominance of this be a good citizen, don't change the structures, et cetera, but certainly in relation to the civil rights movement, what kind of fed people's being not supportive toward it to the extent that I think a lot of people's concept of what a good Lutheran was the law-abiding. You know, it's kind of a negative manifestation. You know, retaining the structures. You know, this is very important. She's going to break up the system.
Yeah. I think of my mother particularly as you mentioned that, because my two sisters and I were not activists in the extreme sense in the civil rights movement, but we did some things and we were very supportive of Martin Luther King and what was going on, and we'd come home and visit the parents. And one time my mother said, "I don't understand how you can be supportive of this for this reason, because it is disrupting the civil order." And all three of us said, "Mother, it's because that's the way you taught us. You taught us from the very beginning that we're to make no distinctions among people, that black, white, yellow, red, we're all part of God's family." And we felt, in order to be consistent in those feelings that our parents had taught us, we needed to support these movements. And my parents, my mother at least at this point, had not made that connection between at least what we conceived as the lack of consistency between, on the one hand, affirming the unity of the human race under God, and on the other hand, opposing the actions which attempted to make this happen in society.
A line that came to me a couple of days ago, just came back to me again, from Stephen Vincent Benet's long poem, John Brown's Body, which the woman says, "In heaven, of course, we shall all be equal. But until we come to that golden sequel, gentility must keep to gentility." And when I think of my impressions as somebody who's sort of learned Lutheranism by osmosis for 25 years, I really see the congregational leadership, maybe the I don't know if it's the training of pastors, as being a big chunk of it, very much keep the establishment oriented. Am I wrong about that? Are the seminaries places where the pastoral leadership is urged to carry out heaven on earth? I'm overstating that.
That's me. Like, they just really, they approve of this. Many of the members of the congregation approve of doing something for these Indians or these people, but they don't want to let the riffraff in. Really, it's the gut level versus the head level again.
Well, it's much safer to be sort of band-aid to society rather than to address fundamental problems within society. And I think even in Lutheran worship that shows. We do things orderly and quietly, and if somebody did something out of line, everybody would be embarrassed by it. And it's easier just to kind of go with the flow instead of raising difficult questions or doing something out of step.
Yeah, I'm totally getting
that. Well, it's kind of like you're saying
that
it's easier.
On the other hand, in the Lutheran Book of Worship, the themes of peace and justice come through very strong in a baptismal service. That's overtly stated, that that's what's to flow from being baptized, is to actively work for peace and justice. So maybe it's said in too orderly a way. Are we missing?
It's not nice. But I was going to respond to Blaine. I think there are situations, many situations, where ministers have spoken out and have become active, and they've been destroyed by their congregation.
I'm well aware of that.
So it has to be,
so you'd see it in the congregations rather than in the training or the church establishment or something.
It's probably all true.
One of the things that's really interesting to me is that, does anybody here know if Orville Freeman was a Lutheran? Is a Lutheran? Huh? If he is, then every governor of Minnesota, perhaps without exception, from 1939 to 1976, was a Lutheran. And you will find in that group of people great variation, all the way from social reformers like Stassen and Youngdahl, to Harold Levander in the 60s, was very much a law. We had a very, very strong law orientation. And a great variety. Didn't that they aren't in politics, but they seem to reflect the same kinds of experiences that, or the same kinds of attitudes that other people have.
I think there's not support from the greater body of the church when a minister does go against the grain of his congregation to speak out on issues that are theologically correct and, in fact, like you say, expected from Christians. The church does not back the ministers up. They just let them.
I think there's more support now than there has been.
But Lutheranism is congregational in interpretation.
Well, not entirely so. There is a synodic or discipline there that's involved.
Maybe the best symbol of Lutheranism as you read it through these is J. William Rehnquist on the Supreme Court, who, as Scandinavian Lutheran, the LCA member, on one hand, we should be proud to have a Lutheran on the Supreme Court. On the other hand, to me, in terms of my theological political views, is a bit of an embarrassment. But that's our Lutheran there embodying a great deal of the claiming of social order presently, the conservative approach to social change, and a real brilliant voice in that particular direction.
Edwin Meese, who is counselor to the president, is Missouri Synod Lutheran, quite active. At least that.
Sometimes I sense a division, you might say, between laity and clergy-laity, mm-hmm. in which we invest all of our, we let the pastor do all the work, so to speak. And for those churches that are able to support a politically active pastor, they're very satisfied to also have him be the person who's out there, where we don't sense that we're all the community ministering together. And so we withdraw and stay in the background.
Okay.
I think the question is asked of pastors and any pastor. And I feel a certain amount of frustration when I can communicate the law, and I find a receptivity for that. And you communicate the gospel and find some reception for that. But I think there's another part of the gospel which I feel oftentimes the congregation has trouble embracing, and that's what I call the third movement, or the movement that calls for discipleship, which means that all of life is embraced by God. And I think of Jesus' response to Satan, "Him and him only shall you worship," which means being active when that is called for, not only through worship, but also how I live out my life on the job. And I don't know where I got that from, but that came through my seminary training or being involved in the Word or whatever, but I find a real frustration of trying to communicate that too. And I don't want to fall into the trap of being judgmental. And I gravitate to what you said. And sometimes I feel like it's okay if I do those things.
One clue in both of these studies, I think, is that the persons in that law orientation, the 40%, tend to have the less education in the total spectrum. So that there seems to be a relationship between law orientation and level of education achieved. The other side of it is that the gospel orientation, which is also spoken to, seems not to be tied to a particular educational level. The point being that it isn't that the gospel is communicable only to persons with a higher educational level. But the gospel reaches persons at all levels. But probably means that the gospel, if it is put totally in abstract intellectual terms, is going to tend to reach persons who are most at home in abstract thinking, and rather than persons who are really thinking, dealing with life in terms of the here and now and what I've got to do today. Suggestion then that we need to become more skilled in presenting the gospel in concrete terms, in terms of everyday life, rather than intellectual concepts or ideas. Think that one over for the next week or so.